Heading to CBC? Make sure to stop by booth 1989 to chat with the Brewbound team, check out our live podcast recordings, and find out about Brewbound's upcoming events. Have news to submit ahead of the show? Head to brewbound.com/submitnews to let us know about your latest updates.
Stone to sell to Sapporo, Modern Times may finally have a buyer, and more on the Brewbound podcast. Hello and welcome to the Brewbound podcast. My name is Justin Kendall and I am the editor of Brewbound, and I am joined by Jess Infante, the managing editor of Brewbound. Hello, Jess.
Hello. How are you?
Has a brewery been sold in the last 5 minutes?
Not to my knowledge, but that's not saying much.
That is not saying much, because I'm sure somewhere in this wide world of ours, a brewery has been sold, because that seems to be what's going on lately. Also joining me and Jess on this journey into brewery M&A, Zoe Licata, Generation Z correspondent, Brewbound reporter extraordinaire. How are you doing, Zoe?
I'm doing well. How's it going?
It's going much better than it was at 2 a.m. Last Friday.
Yeah, I still can't believe you guys did that and you survived and had full, basically, work days after that. It was very impressive.
I don't know what's wrong with us. Don't encourage this behavior. This is deranged.
Honestly, don't encourage it.
This belongs in the DSM-5 somewhere.
Yeah, we can get all into the minutia of how we made the sausage here after we plug our next thing that we're working on, which is Brew Talks here in Boston, July 27th from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time at the Samuel Adams Brewery in Jamaica Plain. Who do we have on our speaker lineup so far?
A lot of great people. I'm really excited. I feel like last week we talked about the taproom panel, and we can cover that one too. But we just got one very exciting panelist who just told us that he was in, Mr. Dan Canary, the CEO and co-founder of Mass Bay Brewing. Dan is obviously the dad of Harpoon, Arctic Chill, Clown Shoes, and now Long Trail and Otter Creek and Shed. So we have Dan joining us on a panel that's going to be all about how craft brewers are dabbling in the fourth category. So RTDs, hard seltzers, beyond beer. Dan's got a lot of experience here. Harpoon for a little bit also had, now it's back under the Harpoon brand, Harpoon Cider. Did a stint as City Root Cider. So they certainly dabble in a lot of things that are not beer. So he's going to join us to talk about his experiences on that front, which also includes an RTD spirits-based cocktail brewed in collaboration with their friends at Whistle Pig Whiskey. So lots to talk about. Also on that panel, of course, is our friend and BrewTalk's presenting sponsor. Well, Sam himself is not the presenting sponsor, but Dogfish Head is the presenting sponsor. And with us will be Dogfish Head co-founder Sam Calagione, who's going to talk all about Dogfish Head's very successful spirits-based RTD line. And we also will have, I would say, local legend, but I really think she's more of a beer industry national level legend, Suzanne Shalo from Craft Beer Cellar, who's going to talk about how these products fit into retail at craft beer cellars, both in Mass and in other states as well. So should be a really great talk about the fourth category. Sam wanted to come at this from the approach that what are established craft players doing to get into this segment of the industry, since it's something he knows really well. And we thought that was a great way to frame this conversation. So I'm looking forward to that. So in addition to our craft meets the fourth category panel, we've got two other conversations that I'm really excited about, and I'm sure you guys are too. We are going to have a little sit down on the state of things with Sam Hendler, who is co-founder of Jack's Abbey and the Massachusetts Brewers Guild president. Sam will update us on the guild's priorities, what's up with the state of craft beer in Massachusetts. And then we've got another panel that we covered briefly last week, but this is all about what's going on with the on-premise segment of the industry. We noticed, particularly here in our home state of Mass, that a lot of breweries were opening second taproom locations. So what does that look like? What are their strategies? How are they approaching staffing? What's important to keep in mind when you're running the hospitality side of a craft brewery? And on that panel, we have co-founder of White Lion Brewing in Springfield, Mass, Ray Berry, White Lion opened up in their hometown of Springfield not too long ago, but they've got a new location coming in Amherst, Mass. We also have Sarah Lee, the general manager of Medusa Brewing in Hudson, Massachusetts, and Adam Romanow, the co-founder of Castle Island, which has recently kind of spread out from their Norwood, Mass location to a South Boston tap room that Zoe and I visited on our little two-person holiday brewery crawl and thoroughly enjoyed the pickle pizza.
Highly recommend to everybody.
Yeah, maybe we can get Adam to bring some Cape Cod pizzas.
Yes, that would be great. And we also will have with us Scott Hempstead, the Senior Director of Local Brands and Tap Rooms for the Boston Beer Company. Scott, affectionately known as Hempy to all of the BBC crew, oversees a lot. So Scott's going to bring a really interesting perspective because he's got insight into not only the Sam Adams Jamaica Plain Tap Room where we'll be that day, but also the Sam Adams Faneuil Hall Downtown Boston Tap Room, also the Angry Orchard in Walden, New York, also Coney Islands Brewery in Brooklyn, New York, also Angel City, and also in LA, and also next door to Angel City in LA, the Truly Hard Seltzer Tap Room. So Scott's got a lot of different threads on the state of the own premise, and it'll be really interesting to hear how he sees all of that because, like, I'd be really curious, like, what goes on at a seltzer tap room? Would love to know. So we'll find out, and it'll be a great conversation. I'm really excited. Hopefully there's pickle pizzas for all.
Yeah. Tickets are available now at brewbound.com, so go pick them up. And this week, we've got a big guest joining us here on the podcast. We have an interview with Courtney Simmons, the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Director at New Belgium and Bell's, discussing the Poured for All campaign and much more. Courtney was just promoted. She'd been at Bell's in November 2021. She went through the transition and sale to Lion. And she's going to talk all about that and what it's like to sort of manage that transition from an employee perspective. But before we get there, let's get to the news. Where do you guys want to start?
I think we got to start with the biggest of the news, which is going to be, in my opinion, Sapporo Stone. What do you guys think?
We've already hinted at it, so let's dive into it. And the big news of last week, and I guess continuing into this week, is, at least in the brewing industry world, Sapporo is in the process of acquiring Stone. That is expected to close in August, I believe. And $165 million price tag on that one. I kind of think Sapporo got a deal. That's brewing facilities on both coasts, the Stone brand, but not the distribution business.
Yeah, dude, I think Sapporo is getting a real deal here. But I mean, I think we can all agree that those days of like billion-dollar transactions or half-billion-dollar transactions are long gone and behind us.
I don't even want to begin to think of the number that Stone could have gotten if they would have transacted, you know, even 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, peak craft time. I shudder to think of the money on the table.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you kind of can't think about that. And you just, well, if you're Greg Cook, you just got to keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Like I think all the time about all the Boston Beer employee stock I did not buy with the discount because I'm a fool.
It's fluctuated some.
Exactly. But if I had some and was selling it last April, I'd be on my boat right now.
Your gold boat. You'd have a gold boat.
I would have a gold boat.
What would your boat be named?
Oh, the piece of ship. Or shit. No. I'm wrong. That was what I wanted to rename my family's boat, which was the Barrel of Monkeys and used to break down all the time. I would name my own boat Ship Faced.
Very nice.
It's been so long that I've thought about owning a boat that I forgot.
Wow.
The standard go-to boat name that I came up with many years ago. Let's stop talking about fucking boats. I'm sorry. So Stone Sapporo was like, this was a day. Like we had an inkling
that something was happening.
And we had had one for over a month and a half.
Yeah. For a good amount of time.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of like hanging over us, like the sword of Damocles. And then we got another inkling that it was the week. And then Justin, you got a good tip that it would be imminent on Thursday.
Yeah. And then I heard that there was going to be a Zoom or something like that call that evening, which would have amounted to about like 2 a.m. our time, I believe. and did some digging, and sort of my suspicions got confirmed that the Japanese stock exchange, I believe the Tokyo Stock Exchange, closes at what, like 2-3 in the morning, something like that.
I mean, it's 3 p.m. their time. So yeah, whatever time that is for us, yeah, was around there. So yeah, we set alarms to wake ourselves up in the middle of the night, like a bunch of sickos. And there was the news. Cause like, while we had an inkling this was happening, we didn't really know what the deal would look like. Cause you did mention the fact that Stone Distributing is not included. And that was not something that we knew before. That's a pretty important piece of this deal, I think.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's one that I don't think really made sense from a Sapporo perspective to acquire. So that could still be shopped. I mean, we haven't heard that it's being shopped. There have been rumors for a very, very long time that it was for sale. Rumors that the company shot down, a previous CEO, Dominic Engel, shot down that the distribution business was for sale. We'd heard rumors that Reyes was a potential buyer, but that still doesn't make sense to me either, because the portfolio doesn't really jive and Russian River would bolt as soon as that went down. They would terminate. None of that seems to make much sense to me, but we'll see, I guess, what happens from here. But we spoke with Maria Stipp on Friday, and she told you and me that they've got some form of agreement together to hold together distribution for Stone at Stone Distributing.
Yeah, she seemed really jazzed about the team there. It's going to be spun off into an independent company, still under the purview of Greg Cook and Steve Wagner. So,
and VMG, Hill House.
And VMG, that's right. We did ask about the debt. We were told that is not part of the story they're trying to tell today. So that was as far as we could go. It does sound like they started to talk a little bit more about it. I think that we must have been among the first interviews they did, and they realized this question was going to keep coming up. So they figured out a way to answer it, but they're still not really giving away much information on that front.
Right. Yeah. I'm almost certain we were, because we certainly, I know that we took the first available slot to talk to them in the morning.
Yeah, we did. I liked our conversation with Maria, but I always like talking to Maria. I think she's really smart. I think she's got a lot of really good insights into both the industry, but also like just like consumer behavior and thought. I remember we did that Frontlines interview with her, and she was so frank with us about, you know, all of the consumer research that they had done lately and what people had told them about how they felt about the Gargoyle. And she was really open to it. And you could kind of tell like she was still new, but it was kind of like hitting her in the feels a little bit. And she realized that they had some work to do to reach certain groups of consumers. So she'll be staying on. She told us that there's practically no redundancies at all. If anything, they're going to have to hire more staff and more talent. So look for that to happen. Although I'm sure people are feeling a little, I don't know. I mean, they've been able to have employee meetings by now, but I'm sure, you know, waking up in the morning to find out that your company that has been, you know, fiercely priding itself on how independent it is, has been sold to an international brewing corporation. I don't know what that feeling is. And I'm sure maybe some people felt a little ill at ease, but Maria assured us that all hands on deck, everybody's needed on this new next phase for Stone.
Yeah. And Zoe, you dug through some of the records that were on Sapporo's website, because as a publicly traded company, they disclose a lot of things. What did that tell you about Sapporo's plans for this acquisition and where they see it going?
Mm-hmm. The biggest takeaway from this was, I mean, this seemed in line with Sapporo's goals for the next few years, which is on expanding both their presence in the U.S. and their production. And so the key aspect of this acquisition for them is they're going to use Stone's two breweries and produce Sapporo beer in the U.S. It's going to give them way more access to the U.S. market and being able to distribute in the U.S. They put in some numbers for what they're planning to increase their own production and just total all Sapporo brand productions by. They're in cases, but they're a little bit different than what we generally think of cases. So for them, one case is 428 ounces. It's a little bit bigger than a standard American case. So consider that when hearing these numbers. But for sales volume of just Sapporo by 2026, they want to have 10 million cases in overseas sales volume. So huge increases in the next few years, supported by this Stone acquisition. By 2024, they want to have 8 million cases in the US. And for all of its total Sapporo sales volume, including Stone, it'll be 30 million cases by 2026. So a lot of beer.
And they've pretty much laid out their own like risk conquest map of the US, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. There's a nice little graphic that we included on our coverage of this with their little, they almost look like little castles, but it's their breweries for the ones in California and Virginia. And though the market areas that will be particularly of interest and supported by those breweries, they want to expand sales in California, in Texas, in Florida, in New York. So it's a nice little graphic. Love these publicly traded companies that can just give us all this information. It's so useful.
Right? So much info and so much math. So much math.
So much math. Shout out to Jess. You really did all those. We have barrels on our coverage and Jess did all of that math to figure those out.
Yeah. If there are any one of the long line of Catholic school educators that tried to teach me math for many years, they'd be shocked at what I just accomplished. But like, for whatever reason, barrel math and clothing discount percentage math, the only two kinds of math I'm really good at.
Both useful.
Both useful, right? Right. It'll be interesting to see. I know, you know, we did not include the dollars per barrel number in our coverage because for a lot of reasons, but one of them being Stone makes hard seltzer and the BA doesn't track hard seltzer. So we don't even really know. You know, the BA's number for Stone's volume of last year is not really going to paint the full picture. So that wouldn't really be an accurate representation of what's going on.
And one of the things to really take out of this is how much Sapporo sort of laid out that they're really interested first and foremost in bi-coastal production facilities to produce Sapporo products, and Stone seemingly being secondary in all of that.
Malt Europe Malting Company is North American proud with premium grains from field to flavor. Our selections include base, specialty, and distillers malt varieties. Stop by our booth 2143 at the Craft Brewers Conference in Vegas. Does your brewing software suck? We've heard it from thousands of brewers. Connect with Ollie today and we'll buy out your current contract and hook you up with brewing software that doesn't suck. Visit booth 1685 at CBC or hit getollie.com/pod.
One more thing to sort of wrap up this conversation on Stone, because we've been talking about this for days and we had a Twitter space to sort of break it all down as it happened. And you can all check that out on our Twitter feed if you're so inclined.
It will be up for a month.
Before we get done with Stone, Jess, you piled through Greg Cook's 2,500 word diary entry on the Stone blog about his feelings on selling the company that somehow omitted the word Sapporo.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. It opened with quotes from Metallica and Heraticlus, and it ended with no mention of Sapporo at all. I think I'm saying that Roman poet's name right. And if I'm not, I apologize. I guess not to him because he's been dead for many, many, many years. Yeah, Greg wrote a very long post on his blog. He's wont to do this. He's done this on several occasions in the past. I was having a chat with some friends over the weekend about how a lot of these craft beer personalities are just wannabe philosophy majors. But Greg wrote a lot about how he's about to be leaving. He'll be leaving soon. And, you know, like this has been a huge part of his life. It's been his career and his like life's purpose for, I don't know, how old is Stone? 26 for like, oh my God, Zoe, they're older than you. Okay. So this has really been so important to him. And he was easily the loudest voice in any room on the craft beer industry about how important independence is and was. And he led that charge up every hill that you could think of. So that's why I think, and we talked a little bit about this on the Twitter space, you don't really see nearly as much outrage over these large craft transactions, not nearly as much as you used to But I think this one's a little bit different just because of how much independence was baked into their like reason for being.
Vehement.
So yeah, Greg wrote a lot about that. And he just said, you know, like, I thought independence was really important when Kraft was still the underdog. And then it wasn't. And he points to 2016 as being the year that Kraft was no longer the underdog, which is interesting because in 2016, I want to say that was their first investment from VMG, mm-hmm. where they launched the True Kraft platform that was supposed to help keep craft breweries independent, but that never really worked out. There's a lot of things that you can point to here. Greg has a whole video that he made himself at that time in 2016 about the importance of being an independent craft brewer. But in 2009, when he was the keynote speaker at the BA's Craft Brewers Conference that year, he made another like really like a lengthier video and featured some really prominent craft beer industry people in it, all touting how important it is to be independent. And it almost frames up craft beer and its independence as like a moral thing.
And how many people in the I Am a Craft Brewer video ended up selling, transacting, you know, taking on private equity?
A few.
More than a few.
So, yeah, I mean, like, this has just been such a huge thing for them. So it was interesting to try to see Greg kind of like wrestle his thoughts to the ground. I don't know that he ever really did. He talked about how he was perhaps a little too loud about it. He called himself a bit preachy at times. He even said, heck, he might have been a bit of an ass at some points. He also thanked a lot of people. He thanked the team. He thanked drinkers. And he said he's going off to embrace his inner introvert, and he's just going to shuffle off to the woods, which could happen, maybe.
Yeah. On Friday, we're trying to figure out how to wrap up this thing. And,
God, you know Metallica.
One of the things that I sort of thought of is 26 years is a long fucking time to do anything in your life. And when you love something so much for so long, there's going to be a point where that thing does not love you as much as you loved it. And you fall out of love in things and you want to do different things in your life. And maybe he's just to that point. And maybe that's too generous, but maybe not. Maybe he's just to the point, you know, that he's soul searched this thing, or maybe not. We'll see if he actually fades to black or if, you know, he's back in the spotlight again.
I think with consumers, the we're independent is kind of a losing argument because consumers, I believe in their heads, and this may be changing with Zoe's generation, which I think would be great, but they mostly just think craft beer and local. They don't always think like independence of ownership.
And purpose-driven, I think.
Right.
I think purpose-driven is maybe even more key in some of this.
Totally, than local. So, I mean, when your purpose driving you is who owns you is, I think that's a hard sell. But I also, you know, spent years on a team that tried very hard to make people very much care about the independence of a large nationally available craft brand. And it's a tough one. It's a tough uphill battle.
I think for my generation, there's part of us where because we've grown up with access to so much information, we've kind of accepted the fact that most places that we get things from, we know it's more often than not owned by a larger company, or it's part of, like, we grew up where this is a very normal thing. And so I think part of it is we're not going to be deterred from certain products because it fits along that norm. Like you said, it's that purpose. It's going to be, well, I'm going to give my money to some company that is, one, going to have a good product, but also going to do something good with that money. And so if that ends up being from a larger company, it's okay. We expect it.
Yeah. I mean, larger companies do have like advantages. You know, like whenever you hear people be like, well, so-and-so's beer isn't good anymore since it got bought. And it's like, oh, I don't think that's true. I think so-and-so, now that they have a parent company with deeper pockets, now has access to better like quality assurance and labs and people whose jobs it is solely to test those things.
401ks, and, you know, they're able to make payroll and safety measures, because I'm going back to Iowa.
I know. I'm excited to hear the Iowa twang. Yeah. It bugs me when people are like, well, they're not good anymore. They got too big. Like, get out of here. That's just because you have something in your head that's telling you that. It's not an actual attribute of the product.
And just from like an institutional knowledge perspective, I think that's one of the challenges ahead for the Brewers Association is when you lose entities like New Belgium, Bell's, whoever it may be, you're losing that knowledge base that came with all of those workers if you're not embracing them. I mean, we saw folks from Bell's and New Belgium at CBC, but I think that there's an argument to be made that there's a lot of knowledge that a lot of brewers would benefit from within those organizations.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see like what conversations are being had at the BA right now and where do they go from here? Do they make a change in the definition?
I don't know. They had a meeting last week.
We shall see.
Yeah, I have no like insight into whether they were discussing that. Probably not.
No, and we should make it clear that we did check in with them last week. I just wanted to be absolutely quadruply sure. And they said, without knowing the specifics of the deal, they could not comment on whether or not Stone would retain their craft designation. And we're pretty sure that they do not, because we know this is 100% buyout.
And Anchor is not included within the BA data set of craft brewers.
Correct.
They're listed on the large brewing entities. Stone and Anchor in the same family.
Siblings.
Two things that sink in a sea.
Oh my God, this is great. So nautical.
Yes. Let's get on to our next transaction. And I think we may finally be closer to being done with this one. Although we still got how many days to close?
14.
14 days to close. And it appears that we have a buyer for Modern Times for real this time.
Yes. As of Friday, we have a filing that was officially signed by the judge that approved the sale of Modern Times to Brewery X for $20 million. That was put in, like I said, Friday. In that, they said they have overseen all the objections and have overruled them. There seems to be no more hurdles necessarily for this process. They have until July 7th to close. So that's 14 days from Friday. So we have a little over a week left. Brewery X has to give Modern Times that $20 million in cash 7 days after Friday. So this coming Friday, July 1st. It seems to be done. We send a message to Jennifer Briggs, CEO of Modern Times, asking her for comments. She seems pretty okay with how things have gone. She said she couldn't give too much comment, but she was really proud of the team that has worked through this whole process and said X stepped up to the plate and it's in the next chapter is their story to tell. So Brewery X is the control is in their hands.
It's in their hands as long as they make that payment. And if not, then our backup bidder is Maui.
Yes, for a significantly smaller, for $15.3 million and a larger closing window, that's 120 days. So for all of our sakes, I hope that Brewery X follows through with all of this and does it in a timely fashion so that Modern Times can move on to its next chapter. But yeah, Maui's still there, still has opportunity just in case that backup bid position could have been another bidder's spot, MTD, who has been identified in the auction filings as True Colors. But they, of course, objected to this and they declined the backup bid option. So it's all Maui's.
And there was one more point that was in this final story that we wrote, which was something that we all knew about, was that there was a lot of urgency to getting this deal done. And part of that urgency was Modern Times was out of money, according to their receiver. And they had to go to the court to ask for an additional $400,000 so they could meet payroll and materials purchases for this week and the several weeks until they can get this thing across the finish line. They noted that there was such a cash shortfall that it might jeopardize completion of the pending auction sale. There was a hearing scheduled for Monday, and we're recording this admittedly before that hearing is taking place, but it seems like they're pretty much free and clear to get that $400,000. The bank was willing to give it as long as the court approved it. And I think that everybody in this case is probably on the same page as far as getting that payroll. that materials cost money.
Yeah. And within that purchasing agreement, it says that the buyer, which is Brewery X, is not going to be responsible for any of those payments that were before the closing period. So if they didn't have this money, it's not Brewery X's responsibility to pay these people. It is still the receiver and the initial Modern Times group. They also aren't required to keep any of the employees that are currently at Modern Times. So TBD on what their plan is there.
Jess, you covered the strike in Philly, and it sounds like Philly and Gritty are going to have beer for this 4th of July after all.
Yes, beer will be flowing in Pennsylvania. Gritty will have plenty to drink. And the workers have a new contract that I bet they're pretty psyched about. So members of Teamsters Local 830 ratified a new contract with Delaware Valley Importing Distribution Association, which is a trade group that represents the three wholesalers that were involved here. So there's Ariglio, which is in Philly, Muller Inc., also in Philly, and then Penn Beer Sales and Service, which is in Hatfield, Pennsylvania. And all of these are in the broader southeastern Pennsylvania area. Teamsters went on strike the weekend before. The strike lasted just about a week, and the wholesalers had stopped taking orders. The media rep for the union told me that there were contingency workers brought in, but they were, quote, met with limited success. Not really sure what happened, but things are back. Everybody's back to work. Beer's moving. A new contract is 4 years, includes a 10.5% wage increase in year one with additional raises in subsequent years, increased pension contributions starting annually in year one, additional 401k contributions, an additional paid holiday. And something that the Teamsters were really, you know, vocal about while the strike was going on was they're working crazy long days. And I think the three of us can probably certainly commiserate with that. But these guys are now going to be limited to 10-hour days, 5 days a week, 2 days a week will be limited to 11 hours, which is not to say that everybody's working 7 days a week. That's not what's going on. But capping their days at 10 hours, still, it's a long day.
I like to imagine Gritty is on a parade route, just tossing six packs to people now, like in Jubilee, that we'll all be able to drink Molson Coors and Boston beer products for the holiday.
Yeah. These were two Molson Coors wholesalers, one AB house. Good for all involved.
Yeah. Our last bit of news here is something that is probably news to both Jess and Zoe, but Jon Moxley is the new All Elite Wrestling World Heavyweight Champion. He won the championship at Forbidden Door on Sunday. And he was crushing Athletic beers during the post-show media scrum. He had his Run Wild IPA, and he is basically calling out Athletic and telling them he wants a sponsorship. So this is me telling Bill Schufelt and John Walker to make it happen. Get this man his sponsorship because he deserves it, because he's giving you all this free advertising. So make it happen. Get John Moxley Athletic beers.
All the beers for John Moxley.
Yes. The man deserves it. He's a good dude. With that, we'll say, what's your 4th of July plans, Jess and Zoe?
I will be doing my usual trip to Hampton Beach and Bernie's, which is always a little chaotic, but a good time. And I think this weekend is the time to do the little Simply Spiked experiment with all my friends and get the verdict there.
Oh, I look forward to hearing those results.
Yeah, tune in next week. We already got our hook.
Wow. I know. There you go. We got a little bit of science this weekend and a lot of drinking some good drinks and dancing and fireworks.
Do you always go to Hampton Beach for the 4th of July? I love this.
This has been a thing for a little while. Yes. I have a friend who lives very close to Hampton Beach. She lives in Seabrook. We have a place to crash. They have a very large outdoor patio spot at Bernie's, so you can not be super crowded in a smelly bar. You can enjoy the fireworks over the beach. It's very lovely. It's a good time.
Nice.
Lots of characters.
I will be at a wedding. One of my friends I grew up with my whole life, my friend Jeff, he proposed to his now wife, Jenna, in December of 2018. They were supposed to be married in April of 2020. They put it off to May 21. They put it off to July 3rd, 22. And he was he called and was like, hey, this is the only date the venue has. What do you think? And I was like, dude, that's perfect. Cause he's one of my Jersey Shore friends. The venue was at the Jersey Shore. We'd all be there anyway. I think the stars aligned here. So we'll have a, I think there's like a pre-wedding party on Saturday night on our beach that I'll bring some fun drinks to if you guys want to, if you want elder millennials takes on various other, actually Zoe, let's do this. I'll get some Simply Spiked. I'll give it to my friends. You give it to your friends. We'll see what the results are.
Yes. I like it.
There we go.
Justin, what are you doing this weekend?
Well, you know, I think I'm getting married on Friday and then I'm going to pack some boxes to get ready for this move. So I will be attending a wedding as well. A much smaller affair.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Just a casual drop. Yeah.
It's a very casual thing. So
very exciting.
Congratulations. Yeah. We're very excited.
We are excited. And yeah, it'll be fun. I'll be drinking the Pliny the Younger to celebrate.
Nice. Ooh.
Finally.
Oh, good. I just had one of mine 2 weeks ago and it was excellent.
I'll be curious to see also some of the displays out there heading into this weekend. So like, I always want to see displays. This is off topic, but I would love for people to send us the best displays that they see.
Off topic. This is more on topic than anything else we've said in the last 20 minutes. Yes. Send us your display pics.
Maybe we can include any interesting ones in our weekend newsletter if they're worth it.
Yeah.
Incentivize it.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited to see them too.
Yeah.
People get creative.
With that, let's get to our featured interview with Courtney Simmons from New Belgium and Bells. New Belgium and Bells recently announced the appointment of Courtney Simmons as the combined company's diversity, equity, inclusion director. Courtney had just joined Bells in November 2021 before the promotion. The company has since announced several programs, including a training program for all bars and restaurants. And Courtney's here to discuss that program and much more. Thanks for joining us, Courtney.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity, Justin.
So we're going to start light here and just dive into the business. Last year, there was this reckoning for so many different companies in the beer industry. Thousands of women speaking out on the way they were treated, the way they were harassed and abused. So you are fairly new to this industry and you were just coming in on the heels of all of that taking place. So as someone who has fresh eyes on this industry, what was your first impression?
You know, it's been super interesting to observe that. I know you're asking about the current industry and we'll get back to beer. I'm a special talent for blowing out scope on questions and projects, but I think it's super interesting that I was coming from 100-year institutions that I think had probably had some of these reckonings well before. I came from an organization where we were not only, I think, well past a conversation around gender inclusion, but we were also very much immersed in that conversation around the racial reckoning that happened for many people within the last couple of years. And so I have to admit that I was a little bit surprised to come into beer and recognize that reckoning was, we're still talking about gender, right? Gender inclusion and addressing discrimination and harassment. And some of the work that many organizations are talking about needing to start feels like table stakes work that has happened well before this in some other industries, certainly longer tenured industries that are maybe resourced differently.
Where do you see the biggest need for change?
I think there's so much opportunity for change. Where to begin? Where to begin? I think that what I'm observing in the industry is that there is an opportunity for us to think about what we're doing internally and what we're not doing internally. I think that that is a huge piece of the work, not only in the craft beer industry, but beyond. When we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, there's often this passion to get out and hire talent and bring people in, right? Like that's the first conversation that organizations want to have. And I think some of the first questions that we should be asking are, what are we not doing in our organizations? Who are we not reaching? Who are we missing? And then that conversation extends beyond within our four walls to our tap rooms and the spaces where we're meeting people, where we're creating community. I think a lot of people talk about how craft beer brings people together, how we don't need to be intentional about creating community because it happens naturally that we already have community in beer. But the reality is that if we're not intentionally inclusive, then we're unintentionally exclusive. And a lot of people, when we bring up DEI, and you've probably seen it on our social posts, they're like, just make beer and stop talking about this. And we already have a community. But the reality is that we have a community for some, and some people are left behind that. And I don't understand why it's so offensive to think about creating a space that everybody can truly enjoy and feel like they're a part of.
And New Belgium is also co-founded by a woman. So what does that make for New Belgium? How, what kind of promises do they have to live up to, the responsibilities that are different for them as a woman-founded company?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I think not only were we founded by a woman, but we were founded by a woman who was a social worker. And so you see that show up in our business in really tangible ways, that that's where our passion for creating a human powered business comes from. That's where our passion for really taking care of our coworkers and making sure that we do right by people, that they can live their whole best full lives at work comes from. And that's where the passion for that human-powered business, again, not just stopping within these four walls, but pushing into the communities, the places where our businesses exist, the places where our fans live. I think that definitely absolutely starts with Kim Jordan and the legacy that she began at New Belgium.
So New Belgium has a perfect score of 100 on the Human Rights Campaign's Corporate Equality Index, and the organization has named the company one of the best places to work for LGBTQ+ equality. So what are some of the policies that are in place that led to the awarding of this score? Because that's huge.
Yes, thank you. So we have a couple of things that we've been doing. We were way ahead of the game in offering health benefits to same-sex domestic partners in the 1990s. We have an on-site doctor with a specialty in LGBTQ+ medicine available to all coworkers. And then we have fully paid healthcare premiums for our coworkers. And so this is work that we've been doing for a long time. It doesn't mean, of course, that we're perfect. I think laws change over time. You can observe what's happening just on a daily basis in legislation. And so we're constantly asking that question of what is our role in showing up and making sure that our space is safe for the people that are working for us, and that we're ahead of understanding policy and advocacy in our role as a leader in this space outside of our organization as well.
So what are some of the things that the company does, like on a daily basis, or like as time has evolved, to keep up with these promises and make sure you're staying in that same zone of being a safe and equal place for everybody?
I think that one part of that is just having dedicated resources to the work, right? Where you have resources in your organization is where your attention is going to be focused. We're certainly making some adjustments to that with my appointment to the company. This work has been happening before me, but I am responsible now for bringing in some strategies so that we're really being deliberate about measuring what we are doing and what we're not doing. On a daily basis, though, I would say we've invested quite a bit in making sure that we have our employees have access to trainings, right? Justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion trainings. We are actively training our leaders right now on behaviors of inclusion. So those small everyday things that you can do to make sure that you're being intentionally inclusive, from decoding language, right? When we say vague terms that not everybody defines similarly, or opening space to make sure that everybody has a voice. Those are a few things that we're doing tangibly. And that's some of the work that I'm super passionate about continuing to invest in with our coworkers now, to say, how do we continue to bring these learnings to life and not only create spaces that are inclusive when it's easy and I'm comfortable and familiar with the people I'm around, but especially when it's really hard and I'm challenged by the ideas that I'm hearing from others.
One of the things that New Belgium has highlighted on its social channels and on its website recently are attempts by companies at rainbow washing, which is when brands or corporations appropriate pride or the rainbow pride flag in marketing, apparel, all kinds of different stuff, with the goal of just profiteering off of this without actually, you know, forming an actual alliance with the LGBTQ community. And making no real attempts at change or championing LGBTQ rights. So how can consumers spot this? And why is this issue sort of at the forefront for New Belgium right now?
there's a few things. So frankly, the guide has some really good information on how to spot it. So I'd encourage you to go out there and share it, because every share benefits our partner. But I would say that I think paying attention to what organizations are doing outside of June. And let's be honest, right? Like, I think some of our fans, and probably the people that are the most critical and not really fans of us, are saying, like, are you rainbow washing by bringing this up? Which is, I think, back to the previous conversation, something that we're continuing to examine, right? Like, how are we really putting actions behind the words that we're saying, and what are we saying? And frankly, there's a ton of posts for New Belgium in June about rainbow washing and about pride. I think as individuals that we can pay attention to what organizations are saying beyond June, right? What did they say before this? And what are they saying after June, and where they're investing, what their policies are? There's some really good links in the guide that help people to go out and see where organizations directing their resources. What if they do support advocacy and political campaigns, where are their dollars being directed? And really being deliberate about understanding how the organization is bringing to life the things that they're talking about in their product sales.
Sometimes when people are talking about, okay, how can we bring more of these efforts to supporting different communities to our company, there's sometimes pushback, especially when we're in a financial hardship, that, oh, maybe our resources have to be somewhere else. We can't focus on this. So what does New Belgium see in supporting these other communities that makes it an actual priority for the company, even when other things in the business might also need to be looked at?
We talked a little bit about the notion that where resources are invested is where we're communicating what's important to us. And so actually, I think we observed early pandemic in my previous organization, we observed a lot of organizations that made a decision at the beginning and the height of the pandemic to cut resources for what would be considered social programs. A lot of, I think, DEI leaders were displaced and their roles were disrupted from where I was sitting. And then all of the things happened with the murder of George Floyd and the watershed moment that happened there, right? And so it was really interesting to observe the organizations that had decided what was or wasn't important, and then finding that they really needed the staff that they had let go. And now I think that DEI practitioners are probably one of the most sought after roles in many organizations. So I think generally speaking, it comes back to that notion that organizations invest in what is important to them. And for New Belgium, to answer your question specifically, it comes back to what we believe in at our deepest core, that we're a human-powered business that is passionate about investing in people and making sure that they can do their best work when they're on the job, so that they can invest in the communities that they exist in off of the job, right? If we say that we're going to do right by people, if we say we're going to care for our people, then we can't do that without making sure that we have inclusive environments that reflect the global diversity of our communities, and we teach people how to care for one another in really tangible, effective ways.
We're in a political climate now in which LGBTQ plus rights are under constant attack. So as a member of the corporate community with deep credentials, New Belgium and Bells can speak truth to power from a place of authority. What are some efforts New Belgium and Bells are doing from a government affairs perspective to let lawmakers know that this is not okay and hold them accountable?
Yeah, thank you. I think that that's some of that really important tangible work that we've talked about. I think, first of all, we're constantly examining what our role is in that, right? We know that we can talk about what is important to us, and that people will listen, certainly our fans, we hope, and people that have influence. We also recognize that there's opportunities for us to sign on to supporting. So, like, for example, the bathroom bill that happened a couple of years ago, we signed on to that. And now, current tense, those are the questions that we're really examining right now. We have a person that focuses on policy advocacy. And what is our role in signing on? What is our role in investing? What is our role in contributing specifically to some of these causes? Today, we don't directly make campaign donations, but we do deeply care about working to support organizations that are doing that important work. So I think, you know, our commitment to the Equality Federation was an example of that, where Equality Federation is doing really good work to understand what legislation is happening and to influence. On the Bell side, Equality Michigan, which is the Michigan-based, because Bell's is based in Kalamazoo, Michigan, is doing really important work in talking about how hate won't win and really working to support and uplift lawmakers that are pro-equality and pro-LGBTQ plus inclusion. And so we're investing in organizations that are doing that really good advocacy work while we examine internally what our role is in being a leader in advocating for things that have a material impact to our business and the humans that we seek to employ.
I want to dig in a little bit on the Poured for All campaign. This was launched, gosh, like just a couple weeks ago, but this really has the potential to make huge sweeping change throughout the hospitality industry. What can you tell our listeners about the initiative itself? Wow, words are hard today, guys. I'm sorry.
No worries. So Poured for All, we're really excited about this one because we feel like it's additive to some really good work that's happening in the industry already, right? We know that there are training organizations out there that teach our coworkers how to be maybe more than bystanders, upstanders, right? Observe when things are happening in the organization that are problematic and step in to create change. Where Poured for All is different here is that this is a free solution that is being offered to our partners. So especially the places, of course, where our beers are being poured ideally, but even people that are not already customers, not yet customers, we want them to have access to this training that is being developed in partnership with Hospitable Me. And it teaches the recipient of the training how to individually be better at creating environments that are inclusive for others. We know that most people don't go out of their way to ruin people's days, right? We're not trying to make people feel badly most of the time. But if we're not being intentionally inclusive, we can be unintentionally inclusive. And so what Poured for All will focus on is creating simple but critical lessons with personal stories that enable bar and restaurant staff members to understand what it looks like to create a welcoming and inclusive experience for people of all backgrounds. And so that we can demonstrate small behaviors day to day that welcome people, right? It isn't welcoming when someone walks into the bar to stare at them. It isn't welcoming to misgender someone. And generally those things happen unintentionally, but Poured for All will help us to be just a little bit more intentional and create more welcoming environments in the places where we pour our beer and don't pour a beer yet.
So since this was announced a few weeks ago, how has that generally been received? Are people excited about it? Are people coming and wanting to participate?
Yeah, so far there's been a really good response. We've even had people, distributors and suppliers that have reached out to understand how they can be a part of both spreading the word and be a part of accessing the training. And so I think that while our target market are people that are pouring beers, there's really good lessons, I think, in there for anyone that wants to be a part of creating welcoming environments. And so we hope that it'll be really not only well-received, but that people will sign up to do it. And we'll, of course, be also bringing it to our coworkers and our own liquid centers and sales and marketing staff as well.
What do you hope this looks like a year from now?
So one tangible outcome of doing the training is that people can get window clings if they wish to, right, and certificates. Honestly, I hope that when we walk down the street to our favorite establishments, we see clear and tangible examples of their commitment, right? First, by a window cling, which feels, again, like table stakes. It's easy to put a sticker in the window. And I hope that when we walk into our establishments that we see a lot of different people. We hosted an event at Bell's for Juneteenth, and we had a band in, and it was such a cool vibe. And the garden was just full of so many different people, right? Like, it was probably the most diverse crowd I've ever seen. And it was such a cool experience where people were just enjoying beer. Like, we really truly did have a community. I hope that we have that kind of experience where there's visible and invisible diversity in all the spaces that we're in a year from now, that people have taken this training and that they're leveraging the behaviors to really actually create a craft experience that truly is for all.
Courtney, you just mentioned the community that was created around that Juneteenth celebration, and that's great. What you said at the top of our conversation about really being intentional about crafting community, I think, is a really interesting idea that certainly doesn't get talked about enough. You know, beer has long prided itself on being a community-driven business. But as we've learned from the reckonings with racial and gender equality the industry has undergone in recent years, not everyone has felt welcomed in the community, you know, and we can easily have an hours long conversation about how to create an inclusive community. So we're going to have you back another time to do that again. But for breweries who are considering making changes, you know, what are some of the questions they need to ask themselves before they begin the work?
I love that question. Let me see if I can narrow it down to just a few, because you're right. I could talk about this for hours. So for organizations that are just entering into this space, I think that really thinking about what is existing currently, right? Really examining what does my organization look like? And I mean that both by looking around, right? When I look at my staff, when I look at my guests, like who is here and who is not. And they also mean not just looking around at representation, but asking those questions of like, how do people gain access to opportunities within our organization, right? If that happens through natural existing networks, if it happens informally, I like to say that that is inherently inequitable, right? If everybody doesn't have access to understanding what opportunities exist in our businesses, then we have to think about how we expand access, how we make it possible for people to be a part of our organization as employees and coworkers, and how we make it accessible for people to be a part of our communities and beer. What types of music do we have playing, right? What types of entertainers do we invite to come in? What types of organizations, if we're doing partnerships and collaborations, are we working with and are we not? Who is left behind in our tendency to rely on natural networks? I think that that's part of what is so different maybe between beer and longer 100-year organizations is that naturally, right, when we're starting something, especially a passion project like starting a brewery with our friends, naturally we reach into our existing networks. But if those networks are homogenous, if those networks look like us, then we have to be intentional about asking who is not here, who is not represented in this conversation, and how do we expand our own networks to have more diversity reflected in my day-to-day life so that when I do reach into my network and pull someone in to collaborate or to share an idea or to brew a beer, any of those things, I have a much richer network to pull from. I don't know if I did a good job being succinct. Again, I could go on for 3 more hours, but those are some of my favorites. No,
that was perfect. And we're absolutely going to have you back to do this again. Because a conversation that needs to happen.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. I think one thing I'd add to that that I missed, and I think it was probably captured in some of my response, but I think it's important to be explicit about, is just simply starting with curiosity. I think that that is so powerful that even again, in the complaints and the frustration that you see on our social for the people that don't love what we're doing is that they're coming with a like, no, this is the way the world is. And it's like, oh no, that's the way the world is for you, right? If you could just take a moment and acknowledge that the way that I move through the world is different than the way that each of you move through the world. And it's different from people that I haven't interfaced. If I can just take a moment to say, huh, that really challenges me. It doesn't match at all with my worldview and expectations. What does that mean? It certainly doesn't mean that I'm right and everybody else is wrong. It means that there are lived experiences that I need to learn more about. And I think if people could just say like, huh, there's something different here than I expected. How do I learn more about that? How do I challenge my worldview? Like, oh man, we could accomplish so much.
Related to company culture, we had Steve Fetchheimer and Carrie Younger on stage with us at Brewbound Live, and they talked about the two companies figuring out how you have your two company cultures and merge it into one. You joined Bell's in November, the same month the brewery was acquired by New Belgium's parent company. So what was that looking like for that big change and that merging of cultures?
Yeah. You know, actually, I had not even officially started. And they said, welcome to the company. Happy first unofficial first day. And we sold the company. So it was definitely, it's been an adventure. It's been a whirlwind. What I'll say is that what's been so great about the experience is that we're really well aligned as organizations. Bell's is deeply passionate about people, deeply passionate about DEI, investing in really tangible ways. And that was some of the first stuff that I learned about New Belgium as well, right? So a lot of really similar themes. And we're actually currently involved in the active process of understanding like, what are the cultural values that we hold at each organizations are really similar, but maybe manifested slightly differently. And how do we say, what like the best of both organizations will carry into the future. And maybe if we have, and we probably have, we certainly have adopted some bad behaviors, right? What do we want to leave behind as we move ahead into the future for the next 30 years? So it's been a really exciting time, I think, to be a part of both organizations, which have such good foundations and are really committed to the success of the past, but using that to inform the success of the future, recognizing that like what got us here won't get us there, and holding on to the pieces that are most important and making the requisite changes we need to be even better than we have before. It's been super cool, and I'm so excited to be a part of it.
What was it like being so new during such a big change?
Well, I think I've learned certainly that I'm resilient and also that I'm tired. But it's been really cool for me, right? And I have to acknowledge certainly my own blind spots in that it was differently personal for me, right? We have really long tenured employees at Bell's that loved being a part of a family-owned company that was locally held. And that's a really important part of our history. And it wasn't personal for me. I hadn't met Larry Bell, right? And so I was just really excited about the opportunity to learn from another organization, to take these two really cool organizations that are doing really cool things and learn from one another. And there's been some adjustment for some of our coworkers, but by and large, I think that people are excited. And I think for the people that are still adjusting, we have really good support for that internally too. Like, we created a Change Champions group, which was specifically designed to hear coworkers' concerns, right? That's another example of inclusion, where how do we make it accessible for people in the business to express their concerns and their questions to someone that they trust and make sure that that information is getting back to leadership so that we can address those concerns and respond accordingly. I'm not saying we do any of that perfectly. We've had a lot of learnings. But yeah, it's been, I think, simply put, it's been a whirlwind. It's been a lot. And I think what I joke, I'm going to hold on to the title of new as long as possible, right? Because then expectations are low for like having answers. But I talk about how I was new at New Bell or at Bell's, and I finally felt like I was getting a picture of what was happening. And then I was new again at New Belgium, and now trying to create one program from those two organizations where there's good momentum and deep passion. It's been fantastic and challenging, but certainly rewarding.
Awesome. Well, Courtney, we really appreciate all the time. And like Jess said, we're going to have you back. So thanks for taking the time out to talk with us today about everything that's going on.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. It was great to see you and chat with you about this. And I can't wait to talk again.
Yeah, definitely.
Welcome to beer. Don't let the trolls get you down.
Thank you. Oh man, I have to stop reading the comments. You know, they say never read the comments. And I like, sometimes I just want to be like, hey, just for the record, did you know this is a real human being with a beating heart and feelings and emotions that you're talking to while you're smashing your computer keys? Like, maybe keep that in mind, please. But thank you for the reminder.
Well, we're glad you're here. And thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
And with that, we'll say that's our show for this week. Thanks to our one-man audio team, Joe. Thanks to Courtney for joining us. Thanks to Jess and Zoe. And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week.